funny hearing that song. It makes me, it brings me back to like being a freshman in my dormitory at Howard, because there was a buddy of mine who was a jazz musician, Kebby Williams. And that was one of the songs he was always like struggling to play. You know what I mean? John Coltrane's Giant Steps. Kebby's an accomplished saxophonist. I'm sure now he could play it
quite freshman
easily.
Year.
Yeah. He was a music major. You know, we were all kind of like, there was a lot of talented people on the floor of my dormitory at Howard.
These lucky accidents, right, that happen and that can change things. And
It's been great seeing so many people, you know, that we just like shared that floor, go on to like doing so many amazing things. So it's cool. It's a cool memory to hear Giant Steps.
Giant Steps. Well, today on Living Writers, Kemp Powers is here in the studio. You're listening to Living Writers. You've got WCBN FM Ann Arbor on, and we are taping this program today. It's April 18th, 2024. If our timepieces and
it's
phones
the 18th.
Can be believed. Kemp, thanks for picking the songs for today's show on the fly, too.
Yeah, very on the fly. My pleasure. If I had like 10 minutes to think about it, I would have probably really, really thought through, but it's just you kind of go back to your standards, basically.
Yeah, like the touchstone ones, too.
Yeah.
And this Giant Steps, it's interesting. I'm not sure here on Living Writers if anyone, Coltrane comes up. He is, you know, he's popular. He's part of this thread that's unifying us over the years. But Giant Steps is not one that's been chosen. And I love that it's like from thinking about, you know, the dorm at Howard.
Yeah. I mean, and if I would have even thought for 10 more seconds, I probably would have switched my jazz choice to Charles Mingus's Haitian Fight Song, which it just dawned on me. I have it tattooed on my arm, a bass with the notes to that song, because my son's name is Mingus. So, you know, it's a funny how, jazz is kind of like, you know, being in a jazz band in elementary, you know, middle school, in junior high school, you know, in high school. And, you know, it was just one of those art forms I really learned to appreciate at a young age.
And so that was your history, like growing up
I played
in
alto
Brooklyn?
Sax. Yeah.
You played sax as well?
Yeah. I played alto sax. By the time I was at Howard, I'd stopped playing. So, but, you know, there were some much better, greater musicians who happened to be, you know, dorm mates of mine.
Yeah.
But I always appreciated music. The music's kind of like been a thread throughout my entire life. I always see and like I hear things musically, even writing. It's kind of like composing a song for me to tell a story. That's why I describe myself as a storyteller, because there's a musicality to how one tells a story. You know, it has crescendos. You know what I mean? There's these moments that kind of like become more sedate. It's about eliciting certain emotions at certain points in the tale, which for me, the tale is kind of like the tale of listening to a song, if that makes sense.
It does.
Okay.
Because and it's the movement of it, too, and that things are shifting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there can be these softer, somber moments or these.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I speak a lot. I've told stories. I do public speaking, but I'm more of an introverted person. So when I do those types of things, I have to work myself up to it the way one works themselves up for like a performance. You know what I mean? Even though I'm just talking, it's psyching yourself up. You know what I mean? It's just like, and as soon as it's done, I kind of like crash and want to just go to my corner for a while and recharge my batteries. You know, I'm terrible at parties. I really am. And people are often surprised because they're like, well, you speak in front of thousands of people and you seem fine. It's like, yeah, I work myself up. But then when it's done, I kind of retreat. So, you know, at a party, I just want to talk with a person I know one-on-one. When it becomes a group, I withdraw a lot.
I think you're brave to go to the parties. I often had this rule, like, only if friends were meeting at a bar, because then I knew I could go in and I could go out.
Yeah. Well, I'm not antisocial, that's for sure. It's just that, you know,
Yeah. But it's true. I understand that even doing, hopefully, okay, Kemp, hopefully this won't tire you out too much, but mm-hmm. sometimes like these conversations, they can be intense mm-hmm. and I can find myself walking out of here without a couple of words to rub together after a while.
It's sure,
like,
sure.
It's interesting to think about like what it is to have this kind of energy, like it's connected with the making as well, I think, mm-hmm. as you're saying, like the musicality of something you're creating and sort of envisioning or seeing the story or discovering it mm-hmm. as it's being built yeah. or so. But the same with kind of creating something when you're talking or to a group of people or so. It's this.
Yeah, yeah. Energy. I mean, the older I get, the less I enjoy the storytelling in front of a group of people thing. One of the great joys of being lucky enough to kind of create my art when it comes to film and theater is that the work can do the talking for me. So I don't have to do as much standing in front of people. If I could see myself in the future, I wouldn't be surprised if I were like one of those recluses who just like puts something out every now and then, and it's hard to kind of pin me down because, again, I'm lucky in that I'm getting more and more work produced, you know, both on stage and in film. And the more work that gets out there, the more I feel like it speaks for me. So now that the work is kind of making the statements that I want to try to make, I don't have to say it literally quite as much. You know, so I mean, part of it, I never went to art school, but I've always found it fascinating when you go and see an artist and they part of going to art school is they have to also not just produce the work, but be prepared to discuss the work. And I understand that, like when a film comes out, I'm always prepared to discuss the work for the amount of time I have to. But then after that, it kind of doesn't belong to me anymore. It kind of belongs to the world. And over time, people start making completely different interpretations of it. And I don't want to shoot anyone down. It's just kind of like how a work affects you is going to be different. There are works that are incredibly powerful and affecting to me that I'm sure don't represent what the filmmaker's intent was. But things make you feel the way they make you feel. The way a scent makes you feel something. You know what I mean? And the way a song makes you feel something. Everyone's not going to feel the same emotion when they hear the same song. It's going to elicit a different emotion based on what it reminds you of. And I think that music, film, all the creative arts, visual art, painting, they all have that ability to kind of like elicit something different. So I'm ready to talk about the art when it comes out because that's part of the job. And it's a fun part of the job, to be honest. It's like, here's this thing I did. But then after a amount of time, it's like, okay, we've talked about it. Now it doesn't belong to me. And you know, it's out there.
Yeah.
Because I'm working on the next thing.
Exactly. And that's the thing that your mind and your subconscious and everything is drifting towards or being like sucked into a vortex of, you know, mm-hmm. being in it.
Yeah, we write, we draw, we sing, we do these things. Sometimes we're sad when we're doing it. Sometimes we're angry. Sometimes we're happy. And our work reflects all those different moods that we're in when we're making it. But that doesn't mean we stay in that emotional state the entire time, you know?
Right. And I also really appreciate how you were saying that the thing is not yours anymore.
No.
And I think that that speaks to something that as a maker, as a creator, is a value, whether it's like implicit, but where it's like you're leaving the part of the art is actually that space that you're leaving for whoever is like, that's when it's complete is mm-hmm. once there's a viewer, a listener, you know, the audience for the art or the creation, because that synergy mm-hmm. is what makes it its own thing.
Yeah. And it's also, it's kind of like a magic trick, right? Like I love magic. You see a magic trick. Imagine if after every magic trick, you're amazed and dazzled. And then mm-hmm. a magician tells you how they showed you how they did it. It would sap all the magic right out of the trick that just delighted you a few moments ago. So, you know, if you've got some meaning that you've pulled from something that me or one of my colleagues has done, and then I tell you, actually, no.
You're wrong.
I don't get the... Yeah. It's like a magician showing you
Well, sometimes you might not even know.
Yeah.
In some of the mm-hmm. layers, or
sure.
be understanding some of how the subconscious potentially was working.
Absolutely.
Especially if you're working in collaboration with others too, because yeah. then that's many, that can be other voices. And
I mean, look, here's a fun fact. Sometimes you don't even remember.
right.
I'm dead serious.
Right. Right. And it doesn't mean it wasn't, it
wasn't
didn't matter. And was, yeah.
In that moment,
yes,
it was all that mattered.
Yes.
But sometimes just a few years can go by or a decade will go by and someone wants to talk about a very specific thing that honestly you don't even remember.
It's like almost, because you're almost a different person by that time because of maybe the things that are you're obsessed about or passionate about or that are something that you're thinking about, you know.
People love to post these little YouTube video clips of actors who kind of in gotcha moments. They don't remember movies they were in with other actors. And it's like, I'd love to work with you one day. And the other actor says, we did this movie together. And it's just like, I could totally understand that.
That's going to happen to everyone.
Yeah. Have you been on a movie set before? There's all these moving pieces. And, you know, we should all be so lucky to have 80 films under our belt. Because if we did, guess what? We'd probably forget things we did with certain performers. I mean, I feel so terrible when I meet someone and it turns out I met them before years ago, but it's like, oh man, I feel awful. But like, and I have an incredible memory and incredible facial recognition. But after tens of thousands of people, you just can't stay on top of it. So, you know.
Maybe I think maybe we just have to be okay with, and the other people too, that it's nice to have that chance to see each other again, and mm-hmm. that's the thing to keep mm-hmm. in the foremost.
Yeah, yeah,
not the. Feeling bad. You know, before we go any further, I should say, you know, Kemp Powers is here in Ann Arbor for Hopwood awards and
yeah, it was a lecture. I did it last night. I got the hard part of this visit out of the way. I did my lecture.
Was it
it seemed to go over really well. I think it was well received. It was, you know, it's winners of the Hopwood Award, so all these incredible creative writing students who hopefully a lot of them, their names will be familiar to people. So I just wanted to tell them something that, as I said in my speech, if it wasn't outright inspiring, was at least like inspiration adjacent. Just tell them some of my personal truths of being someone who creates art for a living, which is, you know, a unique challenge, especially, you know, the world we're in now.
Yes. Some of that art includes One Night in Miami, 2020, Soul, 2020. Oh, and you have the writer that has a rare distinction of two films being released on December 25th, 2020.
Yeah, that was Soul and One Night in Miami.
So
So if anyone saw it, I totally accept that they had no choice. I think Soul was the only thing on television that day because we were all locked in our homes. It was the height of COVID. It's like the only new thing.
But I think everyone needed Soul then.
Yeah.
I think that, thanks.
Yeah, it wasn't prescient. It wasn't like Pete Docter and I and Mike Jones and the whole Soul team. It's not like we were planning for a global, you know, pandemic to blow
Thank
up.
You. Thank
it you. Just coincidentally, you know, we finished that film during the pandemic. I remember it's this, when we were making Soul, you know, Pixar is up in Emeryville near Oakland, and my home at the time was primarily just in Los Angeles, so I would commute, basically. I would fly up every morning on Monday at 5:45 or 6 a.m., go into the Pixar office. I kept an apartment in Emeryville. I worked there all week. Then every Friday evening, I would catch a flight back down to Los Angeles to, you know, see my family and friends. And, you know, we were closing in on the completion of the film, and I remember one Friday I was leaving, and the pandemic, what would become the pandemic, it was like things were getting really bad. And I remember flying home that weekend, and by Sunday it was like, okay, no one's coming in. You don't have to fly back. All of a sudden we had computer equipment being shipped to us, and we were all in our homes and we couldn't leave. And we were finishing animators, everyone. We spent the remainder of the last few months finishing that film from our homes.
What was that like, that change? Because this is such a huge collaboration.
Yeah, it is. I mean, now it's interesting because back then it all seemed so peculiar and odd. It was all about being in person. The idea of even, I mean, Zoom didn't really exist, you know. There was Skype, But yeah, the idea of like a group meeting with 30 people on little video screens seemed kind of like impossible. So, but again, there was like a lot of new technologies that helped us finish what we need to finish. Usually when we record an actor's voice performance, at the time they would either come to Pixar or we'd go to wherever they were. So if the actor was in New York or London, you go to that actor because you got to be in the booth with the person as you're recording. So those were some of the first times we started doing recording sessions where they were in a studio in one city and we were in our homes or in a studio in another city recording them. And now that's normal. That's
the shift.
Yeah, things have shifted that dramatically where something that would have seemed like, no, there's no way we're going to not be in the same room. As the case of making Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, you know, the pandemic ended. We all went back to work. We were back in our offices. But while there were some actors like Haley Steinfeld and Shameik Moore who came in a lot, and a few times we would travel. I travel to New York sometimes to record Luna. There were other actors who were in our film in sizable roles who we never saw in person because we just... That's the new way that you can make things. So it's interesting that it seems so foreign.
Let's take a short break. What did you find out about not being in the room?
I mean, it could be done, but sometimes it felt like there were things missing because there's something about when you're sitting in the room with someone. There's like a banter because, you know, you have these different screens and things. The audio doesn't pick up when someone, you know, it only really is projecting one person's audio at a time. So if two people are talking simultaneously, everyone's hearing one because it kind of chooses the audio and everyone kind of gets quiet. Whereas when five people are in a room together, it's a different kind of banter. It's a different kind of vibe. People are talking to each other. They're kind of, I don't know. It's just you're able to still find some magic, but then there's like a different kind of magic that you find when you're sitting around across from one another, you know. And then you take a break and you all eat lunch together.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and I think what you're saying too is some of what I love about WCBN mm-hmm. FM, like being back here in the studio mm-hmm. too. And with everyone.
Yeah.
And sitting across from you, Kemp.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. Today
okay.
on Living Writers, Kemp Powers is here. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
Yo, my man Fife Diggy, he got something to say.
I like him brown, yellow, Puerto Rican, or Haitian. Name is Fife Dog from the Zulu Nation. Told you in the jam that we could get down. Now let's knock the boots like the group H-Town. You got BBD all on your bedroom wall. But I'm above the rim and this is how I ball. A gritty little something on the New York street. This is how I represent over this here beat. Talking about you.
Yo, I took you out. Perceptions on my mind for the whole damn route. My mind was in a frenzy in a horny state. But I couldn't drop down.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Kemp Powers is here in the studio. Kemp, thanks for picking today's songs. We've been talking about Soul, and we were just talking about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
Mm-hmm.
Let's also talk about One Night in Miami. And I think, do you have in production now Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse?
Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse is in production, but that's one of those like top secret things that no one can say anything about.
But it is, but it's not so top secret that it's not on IMDb or something.
Well, no, otherwise... it was announced when it was announced, you know, over almost a year and a half ago. So people were well aware of it, but I'm kind of sworn to secrecy because there's, I think, a great hunger for the public to get any kind of information, because obviously the release date had to be pushed for that film. Because the Across the Spider-Verse's release date was pushed, and it currently hasn't been announced when it's coming out. That's why we're all...
Okay.
It's coming, though. It's good, you know,
yeah.
People are working on it. They'll see it.
And that means that it's like almost... Well, in production could mean anything.
It could mean anything.
Okay. And I will not keep belaboring the point. And for that, you're the director, as you were in the...
A little bit of news, and most people don't know, I'm not actually doing a third one.
No,
because of the schedule change, I have some other projects that are also top secret that I can't talk about that, you know, I need to go and get onto those, because when we pushed the release date of Across the Spider-Verse, I had to press pause on some things for quite a while. And so, the schedule just doesn't permit me to direct the third one. But, you know, the people who are doing it are some of the most talented artists I know. I know where the story's going. I know it's going to be great. And I can't wait to see what they do.
What is it like to feel like some of these projects, because they're big and they require the input and participation of others too? So this time frame
things take years. I mean, it takes years of your life. It's funny. I was doing the Hopwood lecture last night, and when I was writing it up, I realized that I started on Across the Spider-Verse just a couple of days after we wrapped Soul. So by the time Soul came out, I've been working on Spider-Verse for over 6 months. You know what I mean? So it's like I'm coming off of having been in production nonstop for like half a decade or more on two films in a row. And it's pretty exhausting. So, you know, I don't want to say like I need a break, because I'm still working and I'm working hard on other things. But the grind of production takes a lot. It takes a lot. People, there's a lot of passionate people. I think a mistake that a lot of people make is when they see good art and they see artists, they think somehow that this is a group of people that's lazy, that's just kind of sitting around snapping their suspenders and you know what I mean?
In their mind. As we do.
As we all do. But the reality is, artists of all sorts are among the most hardworking people I've ever come across. That's filmmakers, writers, musicians. One thing that I think a lot of us have in common is we're kind of workaholics.
Because you could always be working or thinking.
And you can't turn it off.
No.
You can't turn it off. And I'm sure it must be maddening to the people around us. But again, that's the people, when we have these careers, all we do is like work. It's hard to stop. Part of, for me, it's just, I got these stories I'm trying to get out. I'm so excited. You know, it's so hard. Every film made is a miracle. And contrary to the definition of a miracle, like, miracles don't happen by accident, or they happen because we're just working and working. And that's the only way we have a chance to make it to the finish line with these things. And we're pushing ourselves and challenging ourselves. And that's like in general. And then with animation, which I wasn't formally trained in animation. I came from live action. I came from theater. Animation is like on such a huge scale. You have so many hundreds, if not over 1,000 people who are all working really hard for a very, very long time to execute these ideas. And they're pretty mammoth productions. They're it's pretty all encompassing when you're doing these.
What is it like with the collaboration? Because right now, because there's many different kinds of collaborations, mm-hmm. like whether you're putting something on the stage mm-hmm. in like a brick and mortar theater or mm-hmm. so, or what you're describing now, which I imagine is like a Pixar experience mm-hmm. or so. Yeah, as a maker, how much
they're quite
are you
different? They're quite different. I mean, I think
how do you keep your vision too? Like what? Or and well, when do you let it go?
Every project is different. Sometimes I don't let it go when I see it through to the end. Sometimes I love handing it off to someone else and seeing what they're going to do with it. As a writer, I like to direct, but sometimes I write and direct. Sometimes I write for a director. You know what I mean? It's very different for each thing. And then I also vacillate between different mediums. You know, working for the stage is such a different experience, and it's so satisfying in a different way than working in film or television, which are satisfying in their way. But a playwright, you know, you're sitting there with a director, you have a dramaturg, and you're in rehearsals, and actors are poking at the things on the script, and you're rewriting in real time. Like, you're making discoveries is the best way to describe it. You know, you're making these discoveries in conjunction with the director, in conjunction with the actors about the work. That's why it's not uncommon when with theater, previews are previews for a reason. For a world premiere, the writer is still rewriting pages through previews. So if you go to see a preview performance of a show, and then go to see it on opening night, you might be like, did things change?
Yes.
Often things will continue to change because we'll make other discoveries once we start performing it in front of a live audience and seeing what they react to, what they get, what they don't get. You know, every playwright's different, but there's a unique kind of alchemy to that that is very different than the collaborative experience of making a live action feature where has its own alchemy because you're on set, you know, you're on a set with people. But then an animated feature, all those things, you have probably the biggest crew of all three, but then it's all being done digitally on a computer. So, you know, I think I love it, but one of my favorite parts of the filmmaking process is actually sitting in a room in edit with an editor. That's you know, that's one of my favorite positions in the filmmaking team is the editor, because then you're making a whole other set of discoveries. You know, you're sitting in that room with the producers and your editor and other filmmakers, and you're kind of like interrogating all this material you have as you try to formulate it into the story you're trying to tell. Television, you have a writer's room. So there's like a room full of writers who are spitballing ideas up against a, you know, a whiteboard. And it's just, they're all so different. I think that it would be a mistake to think that because a person is successful or good at one, that it's just easy to move between each, because it's quite been, for me at least, it's been quite the opposite. You know, the first medium I really started to have any success in was theater. And when I first moved into doing television, it wasn't like, oh, great, you've got a play that's done really well. Here's a TV show. No, I had to go into a writer's room. I had to be a staff writer. I had to kind of start on the bottom all over again and learn the rules and, you know, the art of this new medium. The first time I wrote a feature script, that was like a whole different thing. It's interesting because the only thing I actually took a formal class in of all three was feature writing here at Michigan. You know, like that's what I mentioned during the Hopwood lecture. I came here in 2002, 2003 as a Knight Wallace journalism fellow because I was still a journalist, and I was supposed to be studying global economics. I was working at Forbes magazine, and I was like, well, as long as I'm here in this college, I should take one writing class. And all of the writing classes I wanted were filled except one, and that was screenwriting. And the only reason it wasn't filled is it turns out it was the only, as a visiting fellow, you get to audit classes. Screenwriting was the only class we couldn't audit. We had to do the classwork. So no one wanted to take it.
Oh, that makes, okay, so that makes total sense.
I took a screenwriting class here, and the only formal training I've ever gotten in any of this was screenwriting. So it's funny that the thing that I learned first was like the last thing I ended up moving into. It's just such a bizarre turn of events over these years as I like move from being a journalist into being a playwright, into being a screenwriter and a filmmaker.
Let's take a short break, and then when we come back, let's talk about that arc of yours. Mm-hmm. Kemp Powers, today on Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
I'm so happy, 'cause today found my friends here in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, 'cause so are you. Look on ears, Sunday morning is every day for all I care. I'm not scared, light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did this song at karaoke once. That was pretty fun. Singing Lithium in a karaoke bar.
Give us the story.
No, I used to do a lot. I live in LA.
So LA, you were
LA
at...
is like a karaoke hotspot. I mean, you go to Koreatown and there's just like a million all night karaoke bars. There's live band karaoke. I'd never done karaoke before I moved to Los Angeles, and then
Are you a regular?
Not anymore. I haven't in years. I've been too busy the past few years.
Oh, that's
to
true.
Really,
you're like
to really
it's
do
been
much.
10 years.
yeah. But for a brief period of time, I would do a lot of karaoke, and I remember that was it was a funny night to do Lithium at a karaoke bar on Pico Boulevard.
Oh, nice. Yeah. when you did Lithium, had you already practiced it? You know how you just got up there.
I picked a song. I was like, oh, they have like, I'm going to do that.
And do you have other songs? Like, well, at that time, did you return to like, songs where you're like, tonight's my night four?
Yeah. I would often do like Terrence Trent D'Arby's Wishing Well.
Oh.
I would do an inordinate number of Smith's songs.
Oh, yes.
Like,
because you're
lot
so
of,
sensitive.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's, and look, it's LA too, so let's be real. Like, the Chicano community loves them some Morrissey. So,
I didn't even know that. That's amazing.
So you will hear a lot of the Smiths when you're going to karaoke if it's like a Chicano crowd.
Yeah.
In LA.
Did you have it? What was your Smiths go to?
Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now.
Mm.
I think that was my go to.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That would be a great like Living Writers takeoff where we like everyone's like karaoke songs.
Oh, yeah.
And oh man. Yeah. Well thanks for also picking Nirvana,
because
it's definitely also
such
like,
a 90s,
it's such,
you know,
a time capsule,
it's such
Ken.
A 90s song.
It's so, yeah.
The album that knocked Michael Jackson's Bad off out of number one.
Was that what happened?
It launched grunge. I mean,
yeah.
I was a big Soundgarden fan as well. So, I was torn between that and a Soundgarden song, you know. Rest in peace, Chris Cornell, of course.
Yeah.
I loved his voice.
Yes. Yeah. Did you ever, in Seattle, did you ever go to the Soundgarden, like where the name is from?
Yes. Yeah.
It's like a pilgrimage or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if a lot of folks out there listening have been there, but it's like by the lake and it's a park and there's, I don't know, like metal and different, like there's different structures where the wind moves through it. And,
yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Do you have a better way of saying it?
No, dude, that was great. That's pretty much it. Yeah.
But anyway, so thanks for the songs for today and for that one too. And so before Nirvana, before the break, Kemp, we were talking about your arc, because when you were at that freshman dorm in Howard, were you there to be a journalist? Was that were you?
I was in English. I studied English and history, but I just started working for the school paper. The Hilltop is Howard University's school newspaper. So I kind of started writing for the Hilltop, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I guess I had a better flair for writing than I realized when I went, because I was a heavy reader, you know, a heavy reader of
What did you read? What was your thing? Because not everyone is at the, high school or in middle school.
Anne Rice, Interview with the Vampire, Stephen King books.
Yes.
The Once and Future King. The Scarlet Letter. Just, you know.
Assigned in school or also not outside of
there
class?
Were things that were assigned in school that I enjoyed, like the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Scarlet Letter. But then there were things that, like, friends who were reading put me on to, like Anne Rice, you know, and Stephen King and a lot of fiction. And then, you know, of course there, you know, and then there were things I just discovered on my own, like, you know, Alex Haley's Roots and like the autobiography of Malcolm X and like epic poems like, you know, Syndiata, you know, Malay. I just love to read a lot of different things. So, you know, I just, the first time I sat down and started writing, I wrote the way I've been reading these things. So I think I just had a little bit of a flair for it right away. It doesn't take much positive encouragement for me to kind of feel like, really? Because you're just not used to people telling you you're good at things. So I remember freshman year, it was when you take your first English class, they give you a competency exam just to make sure that like everyone's up to speed in like English and math. And I took my exam and the teacher pulled me aside and said, she said I was too advanced. She thought I was like someone sent to, she told me that she thought I was someone sent there to grade her as a teacher, because she said it was like a professionally written essay. And so first semester, they put me in the advanced English class with mostly seniors. It was argumentative essay writing, I think the class was called.
What was that like? Cause that's a different experience if you're a freshman, and then because seniors seem sometimes old then.
No, it didn't. I felt
That's
totally
great.
Natural at home. Again, I was kind of like a fish swimming, you know. It was something I really had a knack for. You know, I think it was I don't know if it was that teacher, someone else said you should go across the street to the Hilltop and see about writing for the school paper. So, you know, a week or two into school, I walked across the street. I said, I was told that I should come here and write something for you. So they assigned me a story. I went and did some interviews, wrote the story, and then I was a Hilltop writer. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like...
It becomes part of your identity.
It really does. It really does. So it wasn't something I went in there planning to do or studying for. And it's just like, oh, this is good. I'm enjoying this. And I mean, that's kind of like been so much of my, not just my life trajectory, because... You know, when I was very, very young, I mean, I wanted to be like a firefighter. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't really, as I told students, everything that I'm doing today, I didn't even know were things people did when I was young, growing up in Brooklyn. Like, these weren't jobs. Jobs were work at the phone company, firefighter, police department, doctor, lawyer, teacher. Nurse. Like, it was very I grew up in the shadow of Manhattan. Theater was always in the background, but even like theater wasn't something you did, it was something you went to see.
Your mom took you.
Yes,
right?
My mom took me to my first Broadway play, which was Le Cage aux Folles, also known as The Birdcage. I wanted to go see Cats, but you know, yeah. And she was like, oh, I couldn't get tickets to Cats. I got tickets to this. She said, shut up, you know, like, let's go.
Enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy. And I was like, and as a matter of fact, I really enjoyed it. And in school, of course, you know, you had the public theater, you know, the Joseph Papp Theater, and You know, you had Shakespeare in the Park. So Shakespeare was something that was, you know, we were exposed to very, very early on. I just remember in junior high school, like doing readings in the Prospect Park band shell of scenes from The Tempest.
Cool.
Which, you know, I was terrible at, but it also kind of stayed in my brain. I remember the first time I left the country was to go to England, and it was because I got tickets to see The Tempest at the Barbican in London. You know what I mean? So that was like, what was I, 20 years old, 19 or 20 years old?
But it was from that shell moment.
Yeah, yeah. It was from that moment. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Thinking. I was like, I want to go see theater in London. And it was like, what do you want to see? And I'm like, oh, The Tempest. I know.
What was it like being there? Was it what you thought it would be?
It was better than I thought it would be, to be honest. And, you know, I've always had I really appreciated it. I'm a Generation Xer, so I'm that generation that kind of grew up glued to the television. So for me, the first time I was in a live theater where there were live actors, it almost kind of like broke my brain. You know what I mean? I was just like, this person's facing me. I think they can see me.
Right, right.
You know, like it was really.
It's almost too much.
It really was almost too much for me, where I was just like, no way. And I'm like, how do they know all their lines? Yeah, there were just question after question. You don't know when you're a kid what blocking is. You know what I mean? Like, it's just your brain is broken from it. And in Broadway, it was like a whole other level because the production values, you know, Shakespeare, you have some gravel on the ground and you have some actors moving around. You go to Broadway, they're on a damn turntable.
Yes.
Suddenly they're walking
down
a street.
Doors are opening and closing. Yeah.
They're walking down a street and benches are passing by and you're like, no way. This is crazy. So there was a magic to the stage that really kind of mirrored the magic of film and the screen, you know? So there are seminal movies that I went to see, The Empire Strikes Back. You know, I remember seeing that in the theater and just like everyone else going like, it's his father. Oh my God. And then having to wait 3 years to find out what the hell was going to happen. There was like going to see Gremlins and like, I didn't know this was going to be scary.
They looked so cute. At the
yeah, they were cute and they turned into freaking demons. It's just like, and then there were things like going to see La Cage aux Folles, you know what I mean? Yeah. Going to see The Tempest. There are all these, the magical arts moments were both on the stage and on the screen for me. But I didn't know they were jobs. I didn't know they were things. I never envisioned myself at that age doing those things like I do now. Because it just wasn't in the realm. I don't even want to say it wasn't in the realm of possibility. I didn't even know it existed.
So how did that change then?
I just think gradually, slowly, you know, it took years. Like I said, I became a journalist and I thought I was going to retire as a journalist. And if the internet hadn't decimated the journalism industry, I probably would have. You know, I wrote creatively for fun as a hobby. You know, in college, me and some buddies had a little comic book company. We would literally, I would write, they would draw, we would publish these little independent comic books. I always did things creatively, but it was always like for fun.
For the, yeah.
It was always almost like a hobby. But like any quote unquote hobby one has, you do it enough years and you start getting good at it, you know? But even then, I didn't know if it was going to be, it wasn't until college, I think when we were doing our comic books, that was the first time I was like, could I do something like this for my career? But again, it wasn't initially encouraged. Like, you know, I'd send pitches for comic books to comic book companies and, you know, never hear back. Or just there was just, I didn't really know. I had no connections. I had no way of knowing how to get into it, so to speak.
It feels like it would be this great foundation without you knowing it. For like mapping out storyboards for...
Oh, I mean, there's so many things I didn't realize. As a journalist, I was, and it was a bad thing to be at the time, I considered myself a generalist. I didn't really like having a beat.
Right.
Which is the way to move up in journalism is you have a beat because you have sources. I actually enjoy just like learning about a new topic with every story. And the very thing that kind of I felt was a limit to me as a journalist opened me up as a screenwriter and playwright and filmmaker, because reporting became the research that I poured into my creative writing that really allowed me to flourish.
Let's take a short break.
Okay.
And then we'll be back today on Living Writers. Mm. Kemp Powers is here. You've got Living Writers on WCBN-FM. We'll be back.
We on a drive looped in to see ride cooped in. Who gon' slide? Who's in? Big rocks round new 10. Fleetwood down new sand to see ride cooped in. Don't leave round loose ends. Don't be around new friends. We just be mile high clubbing. I'm on 1,000 miles running. It ain't go downtown, sunny. Then moving uptown, money.
If I give it to you, will you leave? Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you're just in time because today on Living Writers, Kemp Powers is here. Kemp, thanks so much being here today. Thanks for coming to Ann Arbor again, this time for the Hopwood Awards and all
I'll be here a lot more in the fall. I'm going to be a visiting professor teaching a screenwriting class.
Yes! That is brilliant!
Yeah. Just they asked me and I said, you know, I thought it would be kind of nice while I'm active in my industry to maybe, you know, try to share a little bit about what I know as a writer with writing students. So we'll see how it goes.
This is really exciting. It doesn't sound like a break though. I know you were saying it's a change of pace.
It's not a break. I'll be in production on some stuff. I'm going to be once again doing one of those crazy old commutes where I fly in here on my class day, teach my class, and then the next morning fly back to what I'm working on. So we'll have to make some plans for the times when inclement weather or things like that. You know what I mean? So hopefully we won't have too many times when we have to switch to Zoom.
Yeah.
You know, for the class. But you know, if they're willing to work with me, I'm willing to give it a shot.
Would you ever have thought that Ann Arbor would be part of your fabric of living spaces?
I mean so many of the places that I've spent significant parts of my life, I didn't expect to be a fabric. You know, I've been in Los Angeles. I grew up never imagining living in Los Angeles. I lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul of all places. Never saw myself living there. You know, I was in school in D.C., you know, spent time in Virginia. You know, it's like life's taken me to some interesting places. The wonderful thing about being a writer is that, like, it's not about, you know, you make every place work. It's about, like, the work that you're doing. And, you know, and that's not even getting into the travel you do for, like, the creation of the thing. You know what I mean? Like, one night in Miami, we shot that almost all in New Orleans, which is one of my favorite places. It already was before we made a film there. But then, like, you know, being down there and, like, really getting to kind of tuck in for a little, you know, for a couple of months while you make a film, you know, it's pretty great. You get to know lots of different kinds of people all over the world. It scratches that same itch that, like, made me so satisfied with journalism.
And sometimes if there's places that are your places in the world, too, I think sometimes when you land in them, you do have a feeling for that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, London is one of my, obviously, London, I've had my play One Night in Miami produced multiple times in different places in England. So I have a lot of, you know, artistic colleagues and close friends and, you know, people who've always supported me there. So that feels like a, you know, like a second creative home right up there with New York and Los Angeles, you know, and I go back and forth. You know, I've been in LA for 20 years now. LA really does feel like home. You know, I have a home in New York, so I'm bicoastal. I'm there a lot, and that's the place that raised me. So no matter how much New York City changes, it's like when I hop off a plane and hit the pavement in that town, I kind of become, I don't know, just like my purest self. I just feel like normal again because so much of the world feels odd to me. But New York is the one place where I just feel completely normal as I am. But it's just, shouldn't everyone feel that way? You know what I mean? Shouldn't you feel normal at home? And I know New York is a place a lot of people go to, but it's just a place I grew up, you know? Yeah. So.
And Brooklyn has seen
Brooklyn's
so much
really
change.
I mean, when I was growing up, you couldn't pay someone to go to Brooklyn if they weren't from Brooklyn. You know, like they were people. It's hard for people to believe that, like, it's funny. Like, I think I went to the Bronx the first time when I was like 19 years old because I was scared of the Bronx. And I had friends in the Bronx who were scared to come to Brooklyn. So it was this weird kind of thing where, like, I'd heard how bad the Bronx was. And I had a friend who was like, man, I heard how bad Brooklyn was. And it didn't seem that particularly bad to either mm-hmm. of us. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. But it's just like, we didn't even realize our own mythos. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like I, you know, my early years, we were in Coney Island. So obviously that great Walter Hill film, The Warriors, I love because it was like so nice to see like Coney Island showcased, even though it was like in a science fiction dystopian kind of film. Most of my formative years were in Flatbush and Kensington. And you know, those neighborhoods, particularly Flatbush, is like a tremendous Caribbean community. That's why I like a lot of reggae dance hall. You know, it really influenced a lot of that community, the way I dressed, a lot of the music that I listened to. You know, the schools I went to, you know, I went to Edward R. Murrow High School, which is in the Midwood community, where Midwood High School also is. So, you know, like it's just like, you know, like these, so much of who I am comes from those environments that I grew up in. You know, like Prospect Park was just like the park on the corner when we lived on Ocean Avenue, you yeah. know, so.
And the scene of The Tempest.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But it was like right there. Like I could ride my bike into the park. And there are memories. Things are different now, but there are these really indelible memories I have. Like Prospect Park is a great example. Had tons of monarch butterflies. There was always like a certain time of year where I'd be like walking along the outskirts of the park and there were just like always butterflies. So you have to understand, like for me, the city is a beautiful place. You know,
yes.
I'm very much, I'm not trying to overly romanticize it. It's just, I'm a city kid. And I mean that in like the best way. Like a city kid can take it for granted, but a city kid can also, I think, appreciate. Like I don't need the city to replicate the country.
Right.
You
exactly.
know what I mean? And I think a lot of times, particularly as cities have gotten expensive and gentrified, people want to turn suburban and country living into city living. Like I cannot overstate how like there weren't really chains in Brooklyn. There were only like a handful. There was like McDonald's and White Castle, but like stores were like bodegas. Bodegas were, I remember when the first IKEA opened in New Jersey, and it was like a big, big deal. I mean, I think that IKEA might have been like the best-selling IKEA in the country because New Yorkers never had IKEA. So if you had a friend with a car or a truck,
yes.
you had them drive you into Jersey to go to IKEA because chains came to New York like late. Cable came to Brooklyn really late. Growing up, MTV, you couldn't get that in Brooklyn. I had cousins who lived in Long Island who had MTV.
So you would go there to watch it with them?
I just didn't watch it. They'd tell me about it.
Oh, okay.
And they'd show me some stuff when I was visiting their house. But I knew it existed. But Brooklyn, and this is like 80, 81, 82, 83, you could get HBO because it had like a cable wire that ran up the building and HBO was all you could get, or this knockoff version of HBO called WHT. But there was no cable in Brooklyn. Brooklyn did not get cable service when cable was out. So I don't know. It's just these weird little things
right.
that were just so unique to like my borough, my city, my block. And I don't know. It's just that's why I'm a storyteller. You know, I tell these stories that, you know, other people who grew up like me get it. You know, they know what it means to take the citywide, you know, the Regents exams, you know, to figure out which school you're going to end up going to. Because, like, you know, you have your zone school, but growing up then, it's that's another weird thing. The 80s, New York was poor, but schools were also more diverse than they are now. So all different kinds of people went to public school when I was growing up. And that doesn't seem like it's the case anymore. I mean, thank God my kids are adults now. You know, my daughter is about to turn 26 and my son's about to turn 20. So, you know, they still, but I'm just, schools change so much. It feels like it's kind of resegregated the way it might have been, like the way I assumed it was for my parents. But I think I was lucky in that the time I was going to school, we went to school with all different kinds of people and all different income levels. You know, I mean, for the most part, Brooklyn was working class. But my point being that, like, lots of different kinds of kids were my classmates.
Yeah. And it's, and that makes a difference.
Tremendous difference. Tremendous difference. I mean, yeah.
For formative years, right? Like, yeah. Like, and just to think, like, exponentially, mm-hmm. what we lose yeah. when we lose that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
then you just have these other isolated structures.
Yeah. And maybe you don't want it. And that's your, you know, prerogative. I'm just saying that people are curious, like, what makes you, you?
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, like, I acknowledge that unique experience that I wish other people had an opportunity is part of, like, what gave me the ability to do these things that I do right now, to gave me this, help me formulate and project this voice that comes out in the plays and the movies that I make, you know? So you can learn a lot from looking at things on the internet, and people do, but it's not the same as being around different people. You know, and being around different groups of people and facing the challenge of having to, it's just different. That's all.
Yeah. That could, I've got more questions, but Kemp, I think this is our time today.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for being here.
Of course.
Thank you for your stories.
Yeah.
And the
I talk a lot. I'm sorry. I get going.
Never apologize.
And then you can't shut me
no,
up.
This was the best. I've loved it. And thanks again for being here.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to everyone out there for...
Jason on the wheels of steel.
That's
although they don't have wheels of steel anymore, but back in the day it would have been...
It's a nice phrase.
Yeah.
It's a good phrase. And thanks everyone for listening out there. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Now, from WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, an hour of programming randomly selected from our archive.
hello and welcome. FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar. I'm going to be joined by Joey Watson and James Meninga, two loyal Lions fans here to discuss a riveting mock draft. How are you guys doing?
Doing great today, Vihan.
Yeah, I'm doing excellent. How about yourself?
Good. I'm fantastic. Do either of you have plans to watch the draft or to go to the draft? Or
I'm not going to be personally attending the draft, but I will be watching it.
Yeah, actually, I had initially planned to be there anyway, but then I got hired to work there for a little bit, so I'll be there for all 3 days.
Yeah, that's awesome. So if somebody wants to call in and congratulate James, we're more than welcome for that. All right, so let's jump right into things. We're going to try and run through as much of this mock draft as possible. We will not be talking about each and every single pick individually, but it's more like we'll talk a group of picks. Joey, you did this a couple of weeks ago, so you kind of get where we're going at. We'll just sort of discuss things at a bunch. I probably won't be leaning heavily into trades because it's so hard to predict, but there will be a couple of trades that I think are going to go down. All right, so let's just jump right into it with picks 1 through 5 because these picks all kind of bleed into each other. They're pretty similar. So at number 1, Caleb Williams to the Bears. Number 2, Jaden Daniels to the Commanders. Number 3, Drake May to the Patriots. Number 4, Marvin Harrison Jr. to the Cardinals. Number 5, first trade of the evening. We're going to see the Minnesota Vikings give up picks 11 and 23 to jump into 5 and take J.J. McCarthy.